Hey everyone, we wanted to be respectful of the changing news that has happened since we originally recorded this episode. When we recorded on Wednesday this last week, 22-year-old Riley Strain was still missing. And tragically, unfortunately, news broke early Friday morning that Riley's body had in fact been recovered in a river in Nashville, miles from where he was last seen. Our hearts go out to his family and friends in this difficult time.
The shaken and disturbed everybody. John, you're still hitting those nice hand signals. You're pointing to we don't know what. You know, now that I live in LA, like sign people on the streets doing the signs to get you into the parking garages and everything is like a big profession. So, John, if this whole thing doesn't work out with your career, I think that you can become one of those sign twirlers. I'm just saying.
Well, first of all, it's not working out. That's number one. Number two, that's in case anyone forgot, Darren lives in LA. Okay, we get it. Darren lives in LA, everybody. Get used to it.
Live in LA. That's why we're all shaken and disturbed here. I am Darren Karp here with John Thrasher. But today, you know, I feel like it's not a menage a trois. It's a menage a trois. It's a it's a fearsome foursome. It's like the Power Rangers coming together. Yeah. Or the Brady Bunch for those out there who watch that. Today we have longtime friends, just good guys here. We've got Tim and Lance from Crawl Space Media, host of Missing and Crawl Space, also our first guest on our old podcast, Marquise and Murder, which feels like centuries ago. Welcome to Shaken and Disturbed, Tim and Lance.
Hey, you guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hey.
I gotta say thanks for having us, first of all. And second of all, I didn't know what to say because there was like 7 minutes of bullet points to kind of check off before we started. And one of them was, there's four of us, so just be sure, you know, we're professional. Don't talk over each other.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, I had to be sure to be professional. So that was my pause.
You know, thank you for putting that out there, Lance. I forgot in one of the bullet points to introduce you guys as extremely handsome, but I had promised that I was only going to introduce one of you as extremely handsome. So at the end of this, we're going to take a poll with our listeners to see whose voice they think is hotter, and then we'll report back with the notes. So my apologies, but one of you is very handsome. Tim and Lance, you guys have been in our lives now. I mean, we started Martinis and Murder in 2017, and, you know, we've seen you guys at CrimeCon over the years, and we've kind of kept in touch, but for those of our listeners who might be kind of introduced to you, can you tell us a little about Crawl Space, what you guys have been up to? I mean, we know Maura Murray, we're going to get to that, but give us a little bit about what your background is and how you guys kind of came into the true crime space.
Sure. Yeah, we got started with our first crime podcast called Missing Maura Murray back in 2015.
Wow.
Originally, we were sort of looking into the culture of web sleuths or citizen detectives who were obsessed specifically with Maura Murray's disappearance. And the goal was to make a documentary about those people. However, a lot of those kinds of people are private and they don't really want to just share their information with strangers. So we launched a podcast to sort of try to meet more folks who are into the case. And that's what happened. And the podcast kind of blew up a little bit, and it led to the disappearance of Maura Murray docuseries on Oxygen.
That was
when we sort of first crossed paths with you two.
I actually don't know if I know the answer to this, and I'm sure you guys get asked this all the time, but, you know, I feel like the number one question John and I get asked is like, what kind of got you into true crime? What was the case that kind of, you know, stuck in your craw or something? Why Maura Murray? Like, do you guys have a connection to that case? Did it happen in your hometown? Why Maura Murray?
Yeah, there's no like family connection or friend connection or anything. It did happen in New Hampshire, and she's from Massachusetts. I grew up in New Hampshire. When I say that, I don't mean I grew up like right down the street from where she disappeared. I grew up probably 2 hours, 2.5 hours away in the White Mountains. But that's one of those, it is the first case, the first disappearance that you look into. Way back in the day, when you looked into it, it was one of the first that would come up. I had been sort of, I don't want to say obsessed, but there was the murder of a young man in the town right next to the town that I grew up in Peterborough, New Hampshire. His name was Craig Lane, and he was stabbed, and it's unsolved, and it really shook the town up. So one day while I was doing some editing work, I was just looking into unsolved New Hampshire cold cases or New Hampshire cold cases. I'd been looking at Craig Lane's murder, and Maura Murray came up. And then once you see the details of Maura Murray's disappearance, it just sucks you in. I mean, it has all of the earmarks of a classic disappearance, a classic missing person story, and you just automatically think you're going to be the one to solve it, because it should be. And all of the elements are there to solve it.
It's like a treasure hunt. You know, you feel like you got all the pieces. Why couldn't you figure it out? In your and John, I'm sure you have questions too, but I just have a follow up here. Like, you know, I think in the past, honestly, I really feel like since Serial kind of came out, which is now celebrating its 10-year anniversary at the end of this year, that true crime has really been this like just huge forefront, especially with Twitter and Facebook and everything online, that people have become these sort of armchair detectives. What have you noticed has sort of been the negative side of that, though? Because sometimes I feel like everyone who feels like they can solve a case muddy the waters sometimes about a case that should be solved. Do you find that too? What do you guys think is like kind of the dark side of that?
Yeah, I would say oftentimes the waters are muddied by folks covering cases. I mean, I think we really struggled with that at times while producing Missing Maura Murray, because in a case that has so few answers, you're not really sure which way to push. Because if you push one direction, it could be the wrong way, and you just don't know. Until maybe you push too far or something like that. So I think that's true in a lot of missing persons cases. And, you know, one thing that we've definitely noticed is sort of cultures developing around other cases as well. And a lot of times they fit the same kind of patterns as the culture that developed around Maura Murray's case, just sometimes in different, different characters or different levels of people involved in that community.
Yeah. I'll tell you something else that, like, you said sort of the negative and the dark side of looking into cases like this. Aside from any content creator that is just doing it in a exploitative way or doing it in any sort of way to get a splash, you know, to get a click or to get a like or to get a download or whatever, you know, there are those people. But there's also another element that will come in. And this is something that Tim and I learned, you know, the hard way. I think a lot of us learned the hard way, is that once you open up your portfolio to a bunch of different missing person and cold cases and these tragedies, you're opening yourself up and you're taking on a lot of other people's pain, and you don't realize you're doing that until it's kind of too late. And then you start to think to yourself, wow, that's difficult. And I need to figure out a way to get through this. But I think a lot of people who start off don't get that. And then they have all of this unfinished work, you know, because they're just like, that's too much. And then they stop.
This was on that topic exactly. That's a question that I used to get a lot whenever I had first started working on the true crime brand of Oxygen. For those who don't know, I worked at Oxygen for 8 years. It was a reality TV network before, but then eventually it became true crime. And, you know, it was weird because it was definitely a big transition to go from reality television to true crime investigations and
Bad Girls Club.
Bad Girls Club to Snapped, you know?
Right.
And one of the things I had to really come to terms with, to Lance's point, was like, once you start opening the door to missing people and just, you know, unsolved cases in general, you know, the families and the friends, they start contacting you, and then we're going to Crime Con and we're meeting a lot of these same people. And it was a little bit rough at first, to be honest, because I was like, this is like a whole new world we're stepping into. But then when we did the podcast with Martinis and Murder, and of course now Shaken and Disturbed, you hear the sort of relief from a lot of these families, especially the missing people's cases, where they're thankful that you're shining a light on it, or you're, you know, potentially bringing more information to the table by just investigating it and being curious. And I think that's something, you know, Darren and I talk all the time. We know all the red flags before the killers do. We know how to suss out, you know, some of these people in some ways. So yeah, Lance, I totally get that. And I just wanted to ask one question to you, Lance, because even though you were 2.5 hours from where that happened, did you get a lot of people that made connections and, you know, in your personal life that were like, oh yeah, I went to high school with this person that now lives in that town? Because I feel like that has happened to me. Like, I grew up in Maryland, and there were weirdly actually a lot of things going on in my hometown. But, you know, in the general region, people would come to me and be like, hey, have you heard about this case that happened 3 hours away? And I was like, oh, yeah, I do have a weird connection to it, even though I'm not specifically in that town.
Yeah, I never experienced that personally with any connection.
Mm.
Because that was 2004. I was maybe 3 years into living in Boston. So I'd left that area.
I see.
And she went to UMass Amherst in Massachusetts, the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And she grew up in Hanson, Massachusetts. So her time in the White Mountains region of New Hampshire was mostly for vacation, hiking, and things of that sort. And I think just that period of time, 2004, was just definitely doing a bunch of other things, and that wasn't on my radar. So by the time it was on my radar, like 10 years later, I mean, there were maybe some moments in that, like my family would say, my sister would say something like, oh, I knew someone who vacationed up there and might have heard of this. So, there wasn't anything super connective.
Well, not to keep rambling, I just had one other thing here, because when we first interviewed you guys, I actually found the document whenever had you guys
Very
on.
Very curious about this.
Yeah, I know,
I don't want to
I remember the room
anything.
We were in. I remember like doing it in that conference room. I remember
I think, did you mention, Darren, you guys were, I think, our first guests on that show, I believe.
Yes, on Martinis and Murder, that's true.
Which was so weird to think of, because you guys set the bar, and you were so fun, and it was such a great conversation. But one of the things I wanted to ask you guys, we asked you guys on the episode, and hopefully I'll be able to pull the audio. I'm sure Oxygen wouldn't mind us, you know, clipping it out. And one of the questions that we asked, I want to ask you again, is what would your reaction be now? What is that? 7 years ago, even longer, I think. Yeah, about
2017
years.
At least
20. 25 years ago.
Well,
I mean,
I'm
still in the womb when we were having this conversation. So yeah. I was a little baby fetus. Yeah.
The question is, and I want to hear both of your thoughts about this. We'll go to Tim first. What would your reaction be if Mara Murray was found to be alive today? After all of the work you've put into this, obviously at that time when we asked you, you guys had the podcast, you were launching the TV show. There have been some developments actually in terms of the investigation since then, but would your reaction be any different than you think it might have been in 2017, Tim?
My God, I'm having flashbacks. no, I don't think so. I think we'd be thrilled. I mean, that was what we always wanted, was for her to be alive and be out there. I think that would be incredible. Nothing about our work would make me happier. To be honest.
Lance, same with you, I'm sure, probably, right?
Well, sort of, but I think I would have a different reaction, because I do remember answering that and saying, well, obviously, like, we really want to have this story end in a positive manner where she's found and she's alive. But the time between then and now, if she's found alive, I would definitely have a much more surprised, astonished reaction.
Yeah, because weren't there like rumors like not that long ago that she was potentially still alive, and people
were
like
sightings or something?
Nothing credible, maybe.
Yeah,
no, nothing credible.
Well,
that would be interesting, though, because like obviously you want the case to be solved, and obviously you don't want anyone to die. Of course you want her to be alive. But part of it is like, I think, and you guys would know this better than me, but part of it when you're studying a case for so long, especially something that is literally not going to be solved until it is, you know, I'm not sure what more information can kind of come out there that wouldn't have already come out unless she's like, hey guys, by the way, you know, it's like John's cat. I've been hiding in the closet this entire time. I just didn't want anyone to like talk to me. There would be a sense of like relief, but also maybe a little frustration, I imagine, just because you sort of feel like, why didn't she put us out of our misery? Like, why didn't she put us out of our misery this whole time, or her family or something like that? Like, a lot of people have probably mourned her. I don't want to say death, because we don't know, but at least mourned her not coming back into their lives in whatever way that would be. And then to kind of have to reverse engineer that, I think, would be a lot of emotional. There's a lot to emotionally wrestle with there.
It'd be a mind fuck. I mean,
That'd be the best way to put it. Right.
It would be absolutely again, astonishing. There would be so many more questions that we never thought we would be asking.
Yeah.
Right. I would imagine so. I would imagine so.
I'm trying to wrap my head around that right now.
I know. And I'm thinking about it too. Like she just popped out being like, by the way,
this is why I asked, because it's like, you know, the unfortunate reality about missing persons cases, especially this one, is sadly and tragically that she very likely is not with us anymore. But, you know, as podcasters in this field and people that are just hoping for the best, it is a reality that like some people do have to think about and come to realize that maybe one day that person could walk back. I mean, we have heard of some of those cases where that's happened. So yeah, it's just an interesting conversation nonetheless.
How long is the length of time before you consider a missing person
legally dead?
Yeah, like legally dead. Do we know that?
Good question.
Is more Murray
varies from like state to state. And I think that's depends on whether or not the family files that after the certain period of time. And I think some families will and won't just based on how they want the investigation to go. You know, if you're saying probably suicide, then it lessens the urgency in the investigation. You know?
Right, exactly. Right. It doesn't keep up that enthusiasm to kind of keep on the evidence and everything. So what is Maura Murray considered right now? Is she considered just a missing person, or is she considered legally? Okay, missing.
Yeah,
okay.
Suspicious missing persons case, yeah.
Hmm.
Okay. And what do you guys think that the biggest lesson you guys have learned in this case so far? Like from maybe 2017 when we first met you to 2024 now, solid 7 years. What do you guys think the biggest takeaway has been for you? And then what do you think the biggest takeaway has been for your audience?
Man, wow, those are good ones. I would say just don't assume like we know anything. I think that's a good one, you know, because it's too easy to think we have absolutes in crime cases, and especially missing persons cases. There's so few answers, and especially Maura's case. I don't know. What do you think, Lance?
Well, I think you're on to that, and I'll just follow up on it by saying, not only do we not know things that people think we know, we're not law enforcement, so we don't get that information shared with us.
Right.
And once people who are content creators and they're covering stories like this come to grips to the fact that you are a conduit for information, just try to make sure your information is as accurate as possible, and don't assume that the family or any friend or husband, wife, whatever, don't assume that they owe you anything. And I think that was huge for us. Like, don't assume a family member, law enforcement, or anybody connected owes you any information that you can then go broadcast on your show for whatever intention. You know, like you could have the best intention, but don't think that you're owed something. And then once you get to that point, then you realize, oh, okay, now I know how I can cover this and get the word out there and have the family listen to it and think I did a good job. And then you can grow that relationship.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Yeah, go ahead. Well,
I think there's covering a case, and then there's like investigating the case. And I think covering the case is going to be met well in almost all instances with family, friends, and things like that. I think investigating the case when you're kind of an amateur crime podcaster or whatever, that can get dangerous. So I don't know. That's one major takeaway I think that I've taken. I think our audience probably has taken that one as well.
Have you guys changed your mind on anything when you started to win? Like now, like we're going to get to, you know, we all kind of brought a missing spoiler. We all brought like our own kind of missing persons case to this that we're going to get to in a moment. And mine kind of deals with this. So I might be jumping the gun, but like when police don't, you know, when police don't give out footage of something, or they do too quickly, or they give out a picture of a suspect, or they don't real quickly, like I sort of see the advantages and the disadvantages of both, right? Like they don't want to give they don't want to give too much information because they are protecting a certain, you know, they're protecting the case, they're protecting people who want to be a part of it. But at the same time, it's also like, well, maybe they have to do that in order to get more information. What do you guys think about how police in general, law enforcement kind of release information to the public for the family and not? Like, have you guys changed your mind on anything, or have you guys been steadfast this whole time?
God, what are these questions? They're so good.
Blown your mind with my questions? I'm
just
so
letting
good.
Darren take
I'm
the wheel
sorry.
Here. Yeah.
No, they're really good questions.
Jesus take the wheel, baby. Yeah. Jesus yeah. take the wheel.
Now you have to answer it,
have I
whether you like
you?
It or not.
Sorry. Well, I'll say we have come into contact with law enforcement that has been incredibly forthcoming, and also law enforcement that will be forthcoming right before we start the interview, and then all of a sudden they become the cop, and then it's like, where'd that guy go? You
right.
know, where what happened there?
Yeah.
And then once we stop recording, then it's like, but I'll tell you this, and then it's
oh,
like,
oh yeah.
So
yeah, we've experienced. Right. I've experienced that myself, actually, in my conversations with yeah. police departments.
That's
yeah.
frustrating.
Yeah, and it's like it's yeah. really by the book, and then we've come into contact with families that have been just absolutely destroyed by law enforcement and the lack of investigation and the lack of respect. And I think, you know, Tim knows who I'm talking about, just how, you know, one family can actually, it's more than one family, but you yeah. know, we've interviewed so many people who have just said, if law enforcement just did one thing, and not even like, I don't want to go on a full law enforcement bashing thing here, but that's the other end of the spectrum.
It's important.
Like,
yeah.
If they just, if it's not like this, it's not like these people are asking for names and addresses of suspects.
Right.
They're just saying, just return the call and show up. Maybe pay me a visit. Maybe just, you know, be slightly proactive in saying that yeah. you're looking at this investigation and it's still on your radar. And don't write me off. And it's so, so terrible.
Tim, same with you, Tim.
Sometimes I find that law enforcement can treat the public like we're idiots, and that's where I feel like they do us a disservice. I'm not saying that they need to treat everyone as if they owe the information, but sometimes I'm like, don't talk down to your constituency. Even in television, I'm like, don't talk down to me, because if you, the moment you talk down to me is the moment now you've lost my side of things. Treat me like an right. equal.
Yeah, I think what family relations with law enforcement is always going to be different and should be very different than public relations with, you know, law enforcement. And I think as far as public relations with law enforcement goes, there's almost no way for it not to be frustrating, I think, because even in Maura Murray's case, and we'll actually probably talk about another instance in Breonna Maitland's disappearance very soon. But in Maura Murray's case, there was the ATM photos from, you know, which are, I believe, the last known view, sighting, or what you want to say, of Maura Murray that mm-hmm. we know. That wasn't released until after the show came out. I believe it was 2018, I think,
oh,
when
wow.
when they finally released, or maybe in the show in 2017.
I think it was in the show. I think I remember that in the show, yeah.
Okay, but the point, I guess, is that I yeah. think police held it back for because they know this, because they know there's always going to be good and bad with this, because so it's out there. So now the last sight of Maura is out there. They're black and white photos. However, people are analyzing the jacket. Is it black? Is it white? It's all. It's almost like that gold viral
the dress thing.
Dress
is it black
story.
And blue? Yeah.
Yeah, and people
blue.
Saw. Yeah, yeah. People saw like reflections in the glass, and so it leads to a lot more work, honestly, for law enforcement. And I don't know if there's any benefit.
I'll just add too. One of the things
it makes me wonder. In Reese, sorry, go ahead, John.
No, I think there's a little delay, Darren. Sorry, I think you're. But I'll just jump in and finish this thought really quickly. One of the things that we've talked about a lot on our show is. And what we've come to realize, I think, is that not every, police department has the exact same resources, and not every yeah. district has the same amount of missing people in it. And even frankly, professionals that know how to investigate this type of stuff. This is where like the podcaster community in the last 10 years, especially, has really come to be a huge influence, because they have the time and the effort and the interest that, frankly, some police departments just simply don't have. And so, you know, I think it's just worth balancing that out there as we have that conversation, because it is partially the problem, for better or worse there. But Darren, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was actually going to bring it back a little. not in a not serious way, but in pop culture, you know, right now everyone's talking about Kate Middleton and how Kate Middleton, it's like, where the fuck is Kate Middleton? And she's doctoring these photos and, you know, her family, you know, there's like a sweater that's off and the tile on the floor. And part of me feels this like, maybe it's about Kate Middleton. Like part of me feels like a weird thing that we're like, I'm just like, leave the fucking woman alone. Like, I don't know, like just kind of leave her alone. Like it's sort of sick and twisted how we kind of do this. And I think people think that they're being sleuths or being like, or they're helping the public by doing this. And I do think sometimes there's like with pop culture, people are doing that for likes and for that. And that I just, I really am like, I think if people donated their time from Kate Middleton to Maura Murray, like that case might've actually been solved. And so that's what's just like interesting about it is how the public kind of puts their view on things.
Sorry to interrupt you, but call me sick and twisted because I'm completely obsessed with the Kate Middleton thing and I have no qualms about that. And I'm really happy to say that I think that she's actually okay. But anyways, all right, that's a really great conversation about Maura Murray. Thank you guys so much for indulging us. I don't know how much of that you like to even do these days because although you were known, I think, for Maura Murray stuff, you've since moved on to you know, Crawl Space and everything else you guys are doing, and you have this missing podcast where you've highlighted other missing cases. And so I thought for today, Darren and I were thinking that each of us could bring a case and shine a light on a case for just a couple of minutes. Each of us have a different one, and maybe just have a quick little conversation, you know, with your expertise, frankly, as missing persons experts, if that's what you even like to be called. I just made that up on the spot. Hope everyone enjoys that. So Darren, why don't you kick us off actually? And you have one that's been really kind of in the news a lot. I've been seeing it all over TikTok. I've been following it. Tell us about
this one's been really popular on social media. This actually is just a current case that is continuing going on. It's only been about 2 weeks old, roughly. We're recording this on March 20th. This actually happened March 8th. So it's only been literally just shy of 2 weeks. It's this college student, 22-year-old college student, Riley Strain. He was a University of Missouri student, and he went missing on the night of March 8th in Nashville. He was out with his fraternity brothers having a drink at like Luke Bryan's bar, and they served him one drink and two waters, according to security footage and according to receipts there, and then kicked him out of the bar for just being too drunk. You know, the parents have since kind of said that maybe he was overserved, but apparently they do have proof that they only served him one drink and then kicked him out. He sort of vanished without a trace. Footage has since been released. It took about a week for police to release this footage, much to the parents' chagrin. Apparently he spoke to a police officer. There was body cam on one of the police officers walking around Nashville, you know, and it was a quick like, how you doing? And Riley seemed good. He was like, good, how are you? He spoke coherently, didn't seem to be in any sort of distress whatsoever. Surveillance footage have sort of come out through the neighborhood gas stations and things like that. There's a lot of CCTV now, for better or for worse in our country, just kind of show him stumbling around, what a typical 22-year-old frat bro would, you know, stumbling on the street. Nothing crazy, but definitely could not drive, was stumbling. He kind of stumbled into a pole at one point, kind of tripping over himself. Again, not unusual behavior, A, for Nashville, as we've all been in CrimeCon in Nashville, but also for a 22-year-old frat guy, this does seem kind of par for the course in behavior. So nothing seemed out of the ordinary there. After he got kicked out of the bar, he told his fraternity brothers that he was going back to the hotel. Now, granted, he was University of Missouri student, so I'm not sure how familiar he was with Nashville. Certainly with us, you know, when we went there for CrimeCon, I'd only been there one other time. I certainly needed Google Maps to kind of get my orientation. So he said he was heading back to the hotel, and what we know from CCTV footage is that he took a wrong turn away from the hotel, and his cell phone last pinged about a mile away from the bar that he was at and subsequently kicked out of. Now, there have been a couple search party teams and police have been searching for this. Some TikTokers recently were on the search party team and found his bank card near the Cumberland River. I thought of you for Cumberland. Cumberland River in Nashville. So TikTokers have found this. The moment they found it, they, you know, got off TikTok. They called the local authorities, which they said was really helpful information. And then even most recently than that, we have the last text message, last active text message that we see from him, which was to a girl he was supposedly seeing or friends with. The parents aren't really sure. She asked him if he was having fun that night, and he responded, good lops, L-O-P-S. I just imagine that was probably, you know, I have fat thumbs. Like, it takes me forever sometimes to type things. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've typed ducking when I should have said fucking. Like, that's a big... So, you know, good lops could have been a number of different things. He could have said good love. He could have said good time, and he just whatever. But people are having a kind of a hard time deciphering this. I'm not confident that it seems to be anything other than just he probably was incoherent, and looking at a screen when you're incoherent is like tough. I mean, I think we've all kind of done that before. But that's honestly what we know. And it's an active investigation. And so far they're sending out, you know, people in the water to kind of look, they're sending out drones, they're sending out like the Marines to kind of look for this guy. But this is the information we know about him so far in the case. And he's like 6'7" also, by the way, skinny, lanky guy, that's but he's like tall. He's not, you'd point him out in a crowd. He's a very clean cut looking guy.
Yeah, Tim and Lance, I would like to know if you've heard about this case and what your thoughts are. But one of the things I'll just want to add is I thought it was really interesting. I saw this on TikTok. I don't know if it's true. I'm just going to say that right now. But I heard that the two women that found his ID card were then being questioned by police, which makes sense.
The reason that was true is because apparently where they found the bank card with his name on it was an already searched area by the party. So I think that they sort of think, was that placed there? Right. Did they just want TikTok likes? Did they, you know, I highly doubt that. They seem just kind of like, it's hard to tell, obviously, but they seemed like good-natured citizens. Like, why would you plant something there? That seems too, like you're going to get caught. Obvious, but I think that's why it seems sussy, because that location had already been kind of checked.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Lance, are there any like thoughts about this? Are you guys familiar with it? Are you noticing anything that might be connected to your expertise in any way?
Well, I don't know about expertise, but it just reminds me of those stories that we had covered on Crawl Space in the early days of the men in Boston who went missing from bars and were subsequently found in the Charles River.
Yes.
And the one thing that gets me, and this isn't anything to do with any investigation, is I always think back to myself when I was in my early 20s and how close I might have come to being one of those people.
Totally.
And you really need to put yourself in that position and say, I might have been one step off of the curb not close enough to get hit by a car. You know, there might have been a moment there where there was a sheet of black ice that would have put me into the river, but somehow I didn't step on that. And those types of things are just like those moments that get under
close
my
calls.
Skin.
Yeah.
That may or may not have happened. And
I think about that all the time. I mean, especially being a woman in college, you know, drinking alone, you know, I went to college on a hill. It was a pretty kind of remote area in Pennsylvania. Like I sort of, you know, people got, you know, robbed here and there, but I never really thought about it. I never thought about walking home drunk by myself. Even in New York City when I was younger, I never really thought about that. Probably naively so, but I think people automatically, certainly my mind when I hear about this is like, was he murdered? What happened? You know, what's going on? Where it just could have easily have been, he's, you know, his wallet fell out of his pocket. He was drunk. He's stumbling. It's hard to have any kind of coherence. What if he fell in the river and drowned? And it's still a shitty outcome, but like, that's just as likely as foul play happening, if not more likely, especially when you're drunk.
I would say much more likely. You mentioned he's 6'7". Is that what you said?
He's very tall. He's tall and lanky.
Guy. Yeah. So that's not like the kind of, you know, physical stature that people looking to, you know, steal someone's wallet would see and then be like, oh, that guy.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And if the bank card was, you know, down by the river, good chance and fair for the police to question those TikTokers. I think that's absolutely fair. Who knows what people would do for likes these days? I don't know. But assuming that's real, then we know he was there. At least he had made it to that point. So theoretically, you should be able to sort of follow that trace and keep searching. But yeah, I would think like water or something like that is probably where you're looking at this point. I don't know.
Yeah, that's and what I Darren, think, especially because he went the wrong turn. I'm like, well, you're drunk right. in a kind of a new area. That is, I mean, I just moved to LA. This happens to me kind of constantly if I'm walking. I'm like, right. wait, did I go left or right? And I'm perfectly sober. I just think it's kind of, it's easy to, there's easy for bad shit to happen that we're not even thinking about. Just
wait,
ourselves.
You moved to LA?
Yeah, did anyone know that yet on the show? I'm just teasing. But Darren,
you know what?
Just...
Podcast done. I'm done yeah, now. She's I've canceling. Said my piece. Yeah.
One last thing on this, and then we're going to move to Tim's case that he wants to spotlight. But Darren, didn't they find his shirt? Like someone was like carrying a wagon that had his black and white shirt in it as well. Did you hear about that?
I didn't hear that. That might have been only on TikTok, and maybe that was just like not that hasn't been perfectly like adjudicated and proven that that's his shirt. Also, like, you're in college, you're a frat, like I probably half my wardrobe was probably my friends too. It's like especially in college and given the circumstances, it's like, what do all these things mean, you know? I think if you're 45 and someone's carrying around your shirt, it seems a lot different than if you're like 22 in a frat, but it's really hard to say. So I just don't think that necessarily has been proven that's his shirt, so that could have just been sort of this TikTok theory. But I wouldn't be surprised if in an hour that comes out as news.
That makes sense. Well, Darren, thank you for that one. And we hope that the outcome is, of course, as positive as it can be for Riley and his family.
Or at least an answer of some sort, because I imagine not knowing is even worse than knowing, but I don't know.
That's right. Well, Tim, what about you? Which case did you want to highlight on today's episode?
Yes, thanks for asking. this is a case that we've worked on for years as well, much like Maura Murray's case. This is the disappearance of Brianna Maitland from Montgomery, Vermont on March 19th, 2004. And again, much like Maura Murray, she recently had a 20-year anniversary of the date she went missing. And that
just
actually,
yesterday when we're recording, actually.
Just yesterday,
Was just yesterday, so this is a very sad case. Shocking that there hasn't been any movement on this case. So Brianna left her work at the Black Lantern Inn in Montgomery, Vermont on the evening of March 19, 2004. And her car was found about a mile down the road with her lights on and the doors opened, and the car was backed into a foundation, the foundation of a house that was abandoned. It was known to locals as the Old Dutch Burn. And it doesn't exist anymore. It was torn down only a few years ago. But I think it's important to note that this was not like a known party spot for kids around Brianna's age. And she was 17 at the time of her disappearance. And had had a lot of friends, had two jobs, was really working on getting her life on track. And we are friendly and friends with her father, who runs a nonprofit that we are on the board of. This nonprofit is called Private Investigations for the Missing. And so he launched this nonprofit to, it was much obviously inspired by Brianna and her memory. But the goal of this nonprofit is to help families who cannot afford private investigators get the help of a private investigator, and that would be paid for by donations. And so the private investigators don't make any money. They get their expenses paid for. No one at the nonprofit makes money. I want to mention too, it's important to note that the nonprofit actually doesn't work on Brianna's case. That keeps that separate. There's several cases that the nonprofit will work on. They don't want to overlap Brianna's case, but I did want to mention that yesterday there was a press conference in Brianna's case. The Vermont State Police and the FBI, I believe Albany's office, sort of did a joint press conference. And this was news to us. Was not expecting this. What they said was that the FBI has put up a $40,000 reward for information leading to the discovery of Brianna. And so that's something that hadn't been...
That's amazing.
Up for a long time. I don't think it's ever been that high. I think at one point maybe there was like a $10,000 rewards, but we're going back over a decade.
Right.
So I think the goal is hopefully this changes something, you know. And the police, you know, we know some of them, some of the retired officers as well, but they don't consider this a cold case. You know, they get tips They consider it a case that they're still working on, you know, very, very hardly.
I have a question.
I have
Go ahead, Derek.
Just real quickly, is there any case that the nonprofit wouldn't take on for a missing case? Like, does something not kind of count as a missing case if you're like, this just seems like maybe a wayward teen doesn't want to be involved with their family or not enough information to call it missing? Is there any modifier there?
Absolutely. And we can't give like specifics for that as far as like what the criteria is, because Chief because former Chief Lou Berry is in charge of the cases that come into the pipeline, and he has 30 plus years experience as, you know, a law enforcement professional, and there'll be a number of criterias that need to be checked in order for it to be moved forward. We're not like super privy to that information. We are told by him when we can't talk about it and why, but there's probably a whole other list in there that
he's got.
But that's not to say that he won't from time to time take on a disappearance of like a dog, which he did and solved the case. But don't contact him for a bunch of dogs. But, you know, these are the checklists that, you know, are contained by that part of the nonprofit.
Wow. That's really interesting. I am imagining, to me, knowing what I know, even just from what you guys are saying, it feels like the biggest, weirdest detail is the car with the lights on and the windows down just being kind of left.
Out of place.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
definitely out of place. Close to her work. Sort of signs of struggle. I think, you know, I don't think the police officially would call it a crime scene, but by all accounts, it seems like something... you know, something happened at that point that, you know, we would know a lot more about where Brianna is if we were witness to what happened that evening, you know?
Yeah. It is comparable to Maura Murray, like Tim said, when you started talking about this, but if you're thinking about the two and one being more suspicious than the other, Brianna's is definitely more suspicious. The back end of her car was literally hung up into the foundation of a house. And clear that she had gone in there, turned, backed up, like she was trying to get out. It was clear.
Oh.
There's no way you put a car into the back of the house without getting a little bit of speed. And why are you getting a little bit of speed? You know, like
right.
You're not
right.
This isn't something that is just like, oh, I forgot something at work and now I'm turning around.
Right. Tim, my question for you was, have there ever been any suspects named or people of interest that were made public at all?
That's a good question too. So not exactly. There have definitely been names. Actually, mm-hmm. the disappeared TV show covered two, I guess, I don't know if you'd want to call them persons of interest or what. They were sort of heavily involved in the drug scene around Brianna's life at that time. Have never been formally named suspects or, you know, that I'm aware of. But I will say that Othram Labs, the great DNA lab from Texas, they got involved in the case not too long ago, a few years ago, and they actually were able to sort of help a little bit. They helped with a piece of evidence that was found at the scene. And Vermont State Police said that they ran that DNA evidence through 11 persons of interest, and it did not come up any hits. So that was also, you know, a little disappointing that there was no match, but sort of news to us that there were 11 persons of interest that they actually were running DNA, you know, evidence against. That was sort of a little inspiring to us. And I don't think we could come up with all 11. I think we came up with maybe like 8 of the likely 11.
Got it.
This kind of makes me wonder, you know, obviously this was 2004, you know, before a lot of tech was really the where it is now. This is 20 years ago now. But now with, you know, John has a Tesla, I'm a big Tesla fan. A lot of cars have cameras, you know, outfitted as if it's like, you know, a police station in there. Kind of makes me wonder, having that technology now on a lot of cars, if that would help solve more cases, just because at least even if it's not in the car, we you know, to Lance's point, you have to get a little speed to get back in there. So what was it like? You know, it's just, it's kind of interesting. Maybe now having those cameras on cars, what that could help solve in the future. Obviously, it's not going to help here, but just really interesting.
My question was, did they run that DNA only against those 11? Did they run it in CODIS or anything? Do you know about that?
We probably did have an answer about that. I would be willing to bet that they did run it in CODIS, but yeah. I guess I can't say off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But they actually, I know I kind of have to dance around what exactly happened, with that,
sure.
But they did, take that sample further, speak to some people, but no suspect was generated, from that DNA.
Got it. Well, hopefully whoever's responsible can be brought to justice, or hopefully Brianna.
Maybe that reward will help and bring
people out of the woodwork. $40,000.
Somewhere, yeah. Thanks for presenting that.
Yeah, thanks for that, Tim. We should also mention you guys you've worked on this case before. We're going to put links in our show notes, and if you're watching on YouTube or Patreon, we're going to put links in there. If you guys want to go explore these cases even further, you can go and do that right in our descriptions. All right, I'll go into mine now, guys, if that's all right with you. This is also a case we actually just talked about not too long ago, and I had picked this case about a week ago and was hoping to have more information on it. Unfortunately, I really don't. This is the Terrence Woods Jr. case. Tim and Lance, are you familiar with this particular case?
No.
Okay, so I'll just do a quick little recap. Essentially,
we covered this a few weeks ago on Shaken and Disturbed, right, John?
Yes.
Maybe
it was like months,
a couple months ago.
Yeah. And I was hoping to have a little more updates, and I'll tell you exactly what I'm speaking of about that in a second. But to recap, the case is basically about a young man named Terrence Woods Jr., who actually grew up in Maryland. He actually went to Frostburg State University, which was my connection to it because I went to Frostburg State University my freshman year. We had some mutual friends from the area, actually, and one of them was a friend of mine named Sarah, who brought this case to my attention. So Terrence essentially goes to, he lives in London or in England for a while, and then is hired as a production assistant, I believe, on a scripted television show that is shooting somewhere very remotely in the United States. I'm forgetting exactly where. I think Montana, maybe, Darren. Does that sound right to you? Yeah.
I believe that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically, out of nowhere, everyone's on set. Terrence drops everything and allegedly runs into the woods, never to be seen again. And there's tons of suspicion around this case. And honestly, guys, please, if you're interested in new cases, take a look at this, because there's a lot of information from family and friends out there. It really is as simple as he dropped his things, according to people on set, and ran into the woods, never to be seen again.
It was in Idaho. My apologies.
Idaho. Just, thank you. No, that's right.
Just re-looked
it
up. Yep.
And you know, there's a lot of suspicion around who knows what, if that official, you know, telling of what happened to him actually even really happened. No one has been listed as a suspect. No one's been tried. So it really is the ultimate missing persons case. I had reached out to friends of Terrence's prior to our original episode airing. I believe it was in December or January at this point. Got some information. It was nothing really to report on. It was more just anecdotal conversations just about Terrence and the type of person that he was, which, as everyone had been reporting, was not the type of person that would drop everything, especially in the middle of work, which he was extremely passionate about, and run into the woods. I personally have a hard time believing that, like, you know, and there are details about phone calls and text messages that we highlighted in our original episode, which again, we can link to in our show notes. But I just wanted to bring it up again. I've reached out to family and friends again. I reached out to the official Instagram account, which is where a lot of the organization around trying to find Terrence is. It's at Find Terrence Woods. That's T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E Woods, W-O-O-D-S. It was interesting. The response I got was just a link to a GoFundMe, which of course is an important part of any missing persons case. You got to pay, as you guys were talking about earlier, you know, you do have to pay for these private investigators if that's how it's going to go out and you know, and how this person will be found. And then the follow-up conversation or the follow-up link after that was a link to another podcast and said, if there were any questions, please refer to this podcast, which I found a little bit surprising. I would expect that there would be a lot of cooperation with people, especially, frankly, you know, podcasters to try to get as much information from direct sources as possible. Although this is allegedly, and I'm kind of rambling here, and then I want you guys to weigh in, but as far as I can tell, I believe that Terrence's dad is handling the Instagram. So of course that comes with its own expectations and understandings of a grieving father trying to handle this situation. But unfortunately there's no real news to share about this case, but I wanted to bring it up while we're talking about missing people. It really affected me. I was really invested and interested. And yeah, Darren, what are your
John,
thoughts
was there,
right now?
Was there I seem to remember there was like possibly like a racial component in this. They were in Idaho. Terrence Woods Jr. Is black. And so yeah. I think they thought that there might be some racial tensions. He was kind of younger on the film set, that there was allegedly perhaps some kind of, I'm going to say palling around, but I don't necessarily mean that in terms of like, maybe they overstepped in terms yeah. of maybe making fun of him or something. And then didn't people on set also kind of notice a little bit of like erratic behavior from Terrence Woods, that he was Jr., that he was maybe perhaps a little out of sorts, if we're going to say that, that there was some odd behavior kind of happening on set.
Yeah, this was the allegation. I think I don't want to like kind of put any words anywhere because
we don't know.
Yeah,
right.
We don't know
alleged.
For sure.
Yeah, we don't know. Right.
Very alleged that there was some, he was acting weird that day, but only hours before that, he was texting his dad about where he was and what his plans were. So that's not really lining up, because if he, you know, something would have had to have gone extremely, you know, awry in only a couple of hours between those. Between that information to his dad and his phone call to his dad, and then him allegedly running into the woods, never to be seen again. It's not to say it didn't happen, by the way. We have to remember, we have to keep all things to considered with what information we do know. But yeah, it's a really strange case. And Lance and Tim, take it away at some point whenever you guys get a moment yeah. to research it. I'd be curious to hear what your thoughts are. Eventually.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about the terrain. In which he
totally.
Went missing. Yeah, what was that like?
Yeah, so
people saw him like go over like a cliff, kind of.
Yeah, the original. So they're on set filming a scripted television show about like mining or something along those lines. So
for Raw TV and Discovery Channel. That's what
that's
they were
right.
filming for. Yeah,
exactly. And so you know, yes, the terrain is like cavernous and rocky and hilly. I think there may have even been an allegation that he slipped and fell and died, and somebody, I'm not pointing any names or pointing any fingers here, but somebody could have covered that up. There's really no telling, because the only people that can know anything were the people that were on the set that day, and they claim that he just ran into the woods. But yes, especially when you consider the geographic location, Tim, that's very smart of you to note that. You have to wonder what kind of potential accidents could have happened. And by the way, maybe he did take off all of his, you know, headgear and his microphones and stuff that you have when you're on a set like that and take off. And then maybe he fell down a ravine or, you know, hurt himself in that way. I don't want to completely say that there's foul play involved here, but when you think about someone just, you know, the visual alone of someone just stopping what they're doing and running into the woods, never to be seen again, it's just kind of sus, as we like to say here on the show.
And but, sorry if you said this already,
yeah.
was his phone records accounted for?
I said this too. As far as we
a
can
ping
tell.
Somewhere, you'd think, right?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, he, of course, I think, I can't remember the exact timeline, but he either texted or called his dad like a few hours before this happened. And allegedly he had, I think in part of taking things off, and I'm talking about headsets and microphones and things like that, I think his phone was included in that. I believe, I'm going to check right now. That was one of the questions that I had asked to the Find Terrence Woods Instagram account, which unfortunately did not get a response. But I was like, you know, where, oh, here it is. Yeah. I said, where is Terrence's phone and laptop now? Have you been able to get access to it? I think this misstep by investigators could hold the key to more information. I had 7 questions. I'll just put it on the record about what I asked. It's been reported that there's been foul play. Is there any, can you elaborate on that? Everyone, the description is that Terrence began running into the woods. Why didn't, and that everyone started to chase after him. Do you think that that is exactly what happened? I asked a couple of questions about ITV, which was his employer. Again, I asked about the phone and the laptop. What were his interactions with anyone outside of his coworkers in those days leading up to his disappearance? Apparently, Terrence also said that his mother was ill and that he had to leave set. This is what he told, I think, his manager or somebody on the set, which was not true. So I was curious what his dad or somebody behind this Instagram account had to say about that. And unfortunately, that's the response I got to that was the link to the GoFundMe and the other podcast. So, you know, it's a lot of mystery. It feels somewhat solvable. I mean, clearly there's more to this case than I think people realize. I don't personally, as a true crime person that does this every week in and week out, believe the official story myself, but okay, that's what they're saying. But yeah, so it's really troubling, and hopefully some justice can be served. And, you know, I hate to say it because it's likely that Terrence is no longer alive, but maybe he is too. Like, wouldn't that be nice that one day we find out that, you know, he was having a hard day and ran off with somebody and coordinated something. I mean, that's pie in the sky, but anyway, so that's that case.
Yeah. I mean, it's
just
also
interesting that it happened on a TV set. Sorry. Sure. Not a TV set, but just happened like while working on a TV show for a
sure.
network that deals with this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder about cell service too. How remote was this area, and was there cell service at all that could have, you know, tracked him?
For sure.
Yeah. Also, if you have a friend or a family member who is experiencing what looks like indicators of mental health issues, I'm sure that had been the case in this individual's background.
Right.
Unless there was just a very sudden break.
Yeah, I was trying to suss that out with the contact I have who's a friend of his. For all intents and purposes, she's saying that he did not have anything like that going on. However, we should also be clear, there aren't always going to be immediate and obvious signs about mental health issues, especially to casual friends or even sometimes best friends and the people closest to us. So we have to keep that in mind as we discuss mental health. It's not always as obvious as people think it is.
Yeah.
Well, that's the Terrence Woods case. Why don't we move on to Lance, your final
one. Yeah, you got one for us. Let's do it.
Yeah, and I feel like coming up on this deep into the recording, my God, I ended up picking one that is so detailed, and I apologize for that.
No, we like that, please.
I mean, we covered this story on Missing in episodes 429 and 430, and it does open up the conversation to a few elements that we always try to touch upon, which is interaction with family members, law enforcement, and a community in general. And this speaks to all of that and just how a system completely failed. And it's a tragic story. You probably know the story of Oakley Carlson from
I actually
Oakville,
have not
Washington.
Heard of this. I haven't heard of this one. Please tell us.
Okay, well, I'm going to pull a lot of this information from a couple of really good databases, uncovered.com and Light the Way Missing. They are very heavily invested in this. Light the Way Missing especially. They have the connection with Jamie Joe Hiles and Eric Hiles. That's Oakley's foster parents or former foster parents. So Oakley, unfortunately, was 7 months old when she was placed in foster care with Jamie Joe and Eric. And she stayed with them for 3 years. And she was absolutely thriving during that time. If you see pictures of her, she's this like ball of energy, always smiling. I know that sounds cliche, but this is absolutely the case. Like this 3-year-old, I don't want to sound cliche, but even when we spoke to Jamie Joe, she was just like this light, you know, just this ball of energy.
You might say she lit up the room. Yeah, go ahead. It's fine.
If it was 2017, I would say she lit up the room.
There you go.
Yeah.
But so the Hiles had the intention of adopting Oakley so that they could obviously give her the best life. Her biological parents, Jordan Bowers and Andrew Carlson, they were not of the best. They were drug addicts. They had been, they're career criminals. And
not fit parents, maybe.
Not in the extreme way. Not fit parents at all. And unfortunately, in October of 2019, the Hiles were notified that Oakley was being placed back into the care of the biological parents. To get into the reasons why would be far too long for this conversation. It's all about the red tape, and it's all about what the law says is supposed to happen. And honestly, the people who are checking in and doing the welfare checks just aren't seeing the reality of the situation. They're just kind of filing the paperwork.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we spoke with Jamie Joe, it was just heart-wrenching to hear how her and Eric had to separate from Oakley that day just out of the blue. They really had no idea that this was going to be happening so fast. And in December of 2020, Oakley went to spend Christmas with her paternal grandparents, Kate and Fred Carlson. And Kate was so concerned that Oakley looked sick. She didn't look well. She was pale, had dark circles under her eyes, and, like, worst of all, she had sores on her face. Child Protective Services was called, and it resulted in Andrew Carlson cutting off communication with his parents. So there's obviously something going on there when CPS comes into the picture and the biological father is now cutting off communication with his own parents because they recognize these signs.
Right.
The last time she was seen alive was February 10th of 2021. But it wasn't until November 6th of 2021, which is 10 months later, that she was reported missing. So there's a giant gap in time, and that's only because a fire broke out in the Carlson home. And the details of the fire are suspicious, to say the least. He claimed that Oakley was playing with a cigarette lighter and accidentally set the couch on fire. I'm not going to bring up the fact that there's a picture of this that exists and there's a crack pipe in the picture.
Great.
But I guess I just did bring that up.
Yeah, you did.
The information.
How was it? How old is Oakley at this time that she's reported missing? How
three.
Old is she? She's three. Okay.
Okay. She's 3 years old. She was with the Hiles, Jamie Joe and Eric Hiles, for about 2.5 years, 7 months to about 3 years.
Got it.
They found that the fire started in the microwave, not the couch. So no, that was where the
origin of the fire happened. Where a 3-year-old goes to do things. Right. That makes sense.
Yes. So there's some statements here from the Oakville Elementary School's principal, Jessica Swift. She had brought supplies over to the family after learning about the fire, and she stayed there for 45 minutes to an hour, and she didn't know where Oakley was, so she asked, and she was told that Oakley was in her room, and that's not, she wasn't shown Oakley in the room. She said, Oakley's in the room. So Jessica Swift, the principal, returns home, and she goes back at a later date and notices that Oakley is again nowhere to be found, and she asks again, and she's told that Oakley's living with her foster parents, which isn't the case because she has been taken away from the foster care, and she's back with her her paternal parents.
Yeah.
So on December 4th of 2021, Oakley's 6-year-old sister goes to Jessica Swift, the principal of the school, goes to her house to play with her daughter. When Jessica asks Oakley's sister about Oakley, Oakley's sister gets very upset and says, Oakley is no more.
Oh, God.
So she asks her more questions, and Oakley, Oakley's sister eventually tells her that Oakley went to go live with her foster parents. And that is sort of the start of this whole journey into where Oakley is. And you also start to uncover all of these things about the parents and how Jordan Bowers, for example, refused to assist authorities. After they were visited and authorities left, Andrew called to report Oakley missing. So that was the catalyst that inspired caused
Never
Andrew.
Never a good sign.
Yeah. Caused Andrew to report Oakley missing in the first place. So authorities went to Oakley's home with a search warrant. They entered the home. They found toys, clothing for all the children except for Oakley. Blood was discovered on the blinds and the front door, as well as a handprint on the wall in the downstairs hallway. And police have never publicly stated whose blood was found inside the home. They do believe foul play was involved. Andrew and Jordan were arrested on charges of obstruction of law enforcement and first-degree manslaughter.
Wow.
The really frustrating part about this, and the reason why I'm delivering it with this tone, is because it's absolutely infuriating, because when you listen to the episodes that we have, especially the one with Jamie Joe, you'll see that there was so many opportunities for CPS to take Oakley out of this situation.
That's what I was
thinking.
There
was so many situations where people were saying this little girl
is
absolutely being abused by these parents. I don't know if you want me to go on, because the rest of this story is how how Jordan and Andrew are subsequently charged with other violations, identity theft, endangering of children. They're sentenced to, I think Jordan was sentenced to 20 months on endangerment charges, and she was released in 2023 and quickly then rearrested for identity fraud. I believe Andrew is free as well. I think he was sentenced to 12 months in prison for 2 counts of endangerment with a controlled substance for exposing his children to methamphetamine. This is also the same story where one of the children had methamphetamine at like toxic levels in his body.
No. Oh my God.
And he was experiencing withdrawals from meth. That's how much meth was in his world.
Yeah, ingesting it too. It was ingestion levels.
Ingestion levels. Yeah. So, again, the reason why I delivered in such a cynical tone is because
it could have been prevented.
It
almost
absolutely could have been prevented. But in I think it's episode 430, the second episode, is when we spoke with the chief. Was he the chief or the sheriff of Grays Harbor, Sheriff Paul Logan, who was incredible. Like, he did have a little bit of that like on air off air personality, but it wasn't as drastic as some people. But the fact that he was contacted by this great organization, Light the Way, they connected us to do the interview, and it felt like really productive to have him on, because he, you know, bottom line, wants to see justice happen for Oakley. And the other really frustrating but inspiring thing is that Jamie Joe and Eric had started a movement, a bill in 2023, a House Bill 1397, the Oakley-Carlson Act, and that was referred to the Human Services Youth and Early Learning Committee. And it's essentially, in a nutshell, to say, hey, you need to have more routine checkups for children that are put back into custody, into a situation that they were removed from with parents who are criminals and drug addicts. And I'm not trying to shame here. It's just you need to check the parents to make sure that they are passing their drug tests, that they're not abusing their children, that they have had a track record of doing. And it can't just be once every 6 months or once every 8 months. It has to be once every 2 weeks
until this,
and then, you know, once every month. And that is super inspiring, because we always love to see, like Bruce Maitland did with Private Investigations for the Missing, taking a tragedy and making it into something that could help others. However, it was shot down on the floor. When it came to a vote, and basically it's just not in the budget. It's just not in the budget. And that just fires you up, because...
And this is Washington State, right?
Just this to is be Washington clear. State, yeah. Yes.
Cool.
So that's the story of Oakley Carlson in a really quick nutshell. But I would recommend people listen to the episodes and also go to uncovered.com and go to Light the Way Missing and check out what they've done with Oakley's story. Truly
tragic.
Yeah.
When they found Oakley aside, you know, when they found that Oakley was at least missing or clearly not back with the foster parents, which feels like that would be an easy check for anyone to kind of. Are the other kids still in the house? Like, were the other kids that they have still there? Did CPS do anything about that? Or once they found meth in one of the kids?
Yeah, I believe the other children were removed from the house, and there was... So that was when that's when that child had been tested, because he was really acting out in a, I don't want to go so far as to say violent manner, but it was a unpredictable,
erratic.
Yeah. And that's when they found that he was essentially going through withdrawals, which led them to those charges of endangerment and child endangerment. And subsequently they're sentenced to 20 months and 12 months, Jordan and Eric.
Yeah, I mean, this, like, imagine your frustration, our frustration, and I can sense in your delivery, just because it's like, it's literally in their name, is Child Protective Services. Like, that's literally their only fucking goal. That is it. There's not really any other thing that they need to do outside of do that. And listen, I have problems with CPS for a number of reasons for certain things. And I think that they are just as, not all of them, of course, but they're it because it's an agency, because of this and that, there's corrupt people that do the wrong things and mistakes are happening. But I just think that this is literally the opposite of their job. They literally did the opposite of what their job was meant to do. And so I imagine that that is just extra frustrating, especially for the foster parents. And because it's the fucking biological parents that did this shit, is just allegedly. But either way, there was sussy behavior going on, even if we can't prove that they killed Oakley or whatever. Yeah. It was not a proper environment for a child. And that is just fucking horrible. That's all I'm concerned.
Yeah. And I actually just misspoke. I said Jordan and Eric when I meant to say Jordan and Andrew. Eric Hiles is a absolutely wonderful person. Andrew Carlson is not. And Darren, you're right. I mean, when we were talking with Jamie Joe, I remember we had a conversation about this as an organization. And this is a community that, an organization that claims to support a community by supporting the success of the children and the well-being so that they can become a more productive part of that community. But that's just bullshit when you hear this story. It's just it's just crap, because they didn't do it. Because there was every single piece of evidence leading up to the next time we visit that house, she's probably going to be dead.
Wow.
And they stopped right before that.
Really tragic stuff there.
So frustrating.
I mean, they do checks on the foster parents,
and they should,
and of course, but when it's time to give the kids back to the biological parents, you know, maybe they just don't do enough checks. I mean, I know the courts are always going to side with the biological parents, so I think that's the tough spot there, is that they're really always going to, but you just never expect like that. The biological parents to be such like shitbags.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's like, yeah.
Well,
that's
said.
That's so hard.
That's a really tough one. Well, Lance, thank you for sharing that. And again, you guys listening, you can go and listen to these episodes right now on their feeds. We have linked everything in our show notes.
Put them in our show notes. Yep.
Yeah, and in the description on YouTube and on Patreon.
To mention, we had talked about Maura Murray in the beginning and our coverage on her and her story and her family. However, Julie Murray, her sister, has really risen to the occasion by releasing a show of her own called Media Pressure. So if anybody wants more accurate
firsthand
details, straight from Julie, it's a really, really great show. And can't recommend that enough. But, you know, listen to our show too.
Listen to everybody's show. Come on.
Yeah. Right. we haven't been covering Maura Murray's case in at least a couple of years now. And we couldn't be happier that Julie has sort of taken on the role that she has with her new podcast. I think that's great.
I would see her on TikTok all the time. So I'm glad to see that she was on my For You page several times. I followed and you know, championed what she's trying to do there to spread the awareness. She seems to have a really, healthy approach to that conversation, given that it was her sister. And, you know, I think TikTok is we make fun of TikTok, but it's a great way to get, you know, this type of information out into the world. So, well, guys, this has been
This is amazing.
Fun,
thank
heartbreaking,
you guys for
coming on. Amazing. Yeah. Yeah, there's been so many different emotions in this episode, but
we hope we don't have to wait a few years. Yeah, we did. We cursed each other out. Yeah. We hugged each other out. It was all.
I just talked over you, so I violated a rule.
Yeah, rule number one, Dick. Rule number one.
I have it on the top of the document. Do not talk over each other. But it's
what
fine.
The fuck? I do this all the time. No, you guys are. We just love you. We respect you guys so much for what you guys do for the community and what you do on your own free time. Just to like help solve these cases. I mean, we honestly couldn't say it enough. We're lucky to kind of have you in our orbit, and we hope we don't have to wait a few years to have you guys back on. Feel free. This is an open door policy to come on anytime you guys want to talk about anything, because we just love having you. And plug your shit. We want our listeners to live to your stuff too. So yeah, plug whatever you guys want to plug, because we want to get as many listens to you guys as possible.
Tim, why don't you go first?
Thanks a lot. Yeah, we love you guys too, and have nothing but respect for you guys, and are so happy we're in the same orbit as you. Thank you. We do the Missing podcast. You can find it. It's called Missing. We also do one called Crawl Space. We have been on a little bit of a break the past month or so, but we are going to resume production very soon. Some crazy things are going on behind the scenes that will make a great story someday, but not yet.
I may have been a little privy to some of that, but that's for another time. Yeah,
we're gonna launch a tour called Podcast Confidential.
I would like to be the MC of that, if nothing else.
I thought you guys were going to launch your OnlyFans on here, but I guess we're going to have to wait a month to get that announcement. Fine. Whatever.
Much to everyone's chagrin.
Yes.
Tidy up the OnlyFans. I am going to also say we love you guys and we respect you guys. And yes, it's been an absolute pleasure to come back on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Having us again. And one more thing to plug over the summer and into the fall. Our partner, Jennifer Amell, produced, she wrote, directed, edited an amazing show. And I'm not just saying it because it's, you know, a friend of ours and a partner of ours called Dark Valley. It's about the Connecticut River Valley murders that happened between 1978 and 1988. They're unsolved. But Jennifer approached it in this incredible feministic way where she told the stories of the women who did not survive, along with Jane Borofsky, who is the only known surviving victim. And wow. Jane was stabbed 27 times. She survived. Wow. And ugh. It's taken her since 1988 to really tell her story the way she's told it in Dark Valley. And it is astounding.
Wow.
Couldn't be more proud of it. And once we get through this absolutely fucking bonkers time that we're going through behind the scenes, hopefully we'll see more seasons of this. So stay tuned for that. But yeah, Dark Valley is something that we're super proud of. Not like it was accepted to Tribeca Film Festival, but it was definitely accepted to Tribeca Film Festival.
The creator's market. Yeah.
Creator's market. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, I mean, come on now. That's amazing.
De Niro was, you know, first in line to.
He loves it. Yeah, De Niro's the biggest fan of it.
Yep. Wow.
Oh, well, that's incredible. Check that out.
We don't know that for sure.
Oh, I was like,
no,
really?
that's an alleged. It's fine. We'll keep that fact going. We're not about facts and figures. It's fine.
He didn't say Robert De Niro.
I was gonna say this is Francesco De Niro from.
This is Darren De Niro. You know, Darren De Niro down the street. No shit.
Loves Dark Valley.
Loves it. Big fan.
That's amazing.
Well, Tim and Lance, we love you. Thank you guys so much for bringing all of your just class act and your information to us. And we hope to have you guys on again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
See you soon.